Welcome to Just JKing, the podcast where we transform your HR headaches into high fives. Whether you're a founder, CEO, or just someone with HR questions you're too afraid to ask, we've got the insights, laughs, and light bulb moments that you crave.
Enjoying the show? Hit that five-star review and subscribe now so you never miss out.
Welcome back to Just JKing.
Today, our very special guest is Christopher Gillis.
Christopher has navigated the world of HR from the ground up, working with diverse groups, shift workers, and often underserved staff like housekeeping teams in luxury hotels and on cruise ships. But he didn't stop there. He went on to shape policy at the highest levels, eventually becoming a deputy minister in Prince Edward Island provincial government, holding multiple senior HR roles along the way.
Today, we're going to unpack Christopher's journey from shifting mindsets in HR to leading transformative policy. Get ready for insights you won't hear anywhere else.
Welcome to the podcast, Christopher.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. What drew you to HR and how did your background in policy shape your approach to HR?
Great question. I will have to start kind of at the before the beginning for me. So fresh out of high school, I went to Toronto. I went to Ryerson University and did the dance program there. So I wanted to go to dance school, theater school to be a star. And I finished school. I ended up finishing at George Brown College. And then I had a bit of a career in theater for a couple of years living in Toronto. But after a number of years, I got really obviously, you know, demoralized. My hopes and dreams of becoming a star by 30 weren't on track. And I got really tired of, you know, sort of downtown Toronto living. You know, obviously I was waiting tables, didn't have a lot of money. I wanted more for me and for my life. So I decided, okay, I'm going to go back to school and get a great, solid academic education that's going to set me up for success. And success at that time for me was defined as a good, stable job with good pay. So I went back to school. I came here to University of PEI and I did a political science undergrad. And then while I was studying my undergrad, I took courses in public policy and public administration. And I really liked it. And I really thought, oh, this is it. You know, when you're doing a political science undergrad, you're trying to figure out, do I want to go international? Is there something around kind of domestic government? You know, so public policy, public admin is one of those disciplines and it really spoke to me. So I went and did my master's degree at Queen's University in public administration, public policy. And it was a great program. It's a wonderful program. You kind of enter in September and they shoot you out the other side in the spring with a job. And I was fortunate. I got a job working for the federal government. And I was hired then as a policy intern. I became a junior policy analyst and a policy analyst, senior policy analyst, et cetera. It wasn't very long after I started working for the federal government that I realized probably this wasn't the right environment for me. And that although I do love public policy and the study of it and public administration, the environment is very different than that study. So here I was with my newfound, you know, solid academic education, and I really wanted to kind of take that out for a turn. And the environment wasn't really kind of allowing me to do that and to spread my wings. By that point, I had started teaching as a sessional professor at UPEI in Canadian politics, and I loved it. And I taught that, you know, semester after semester for about 5 years. And that overlapped with my time working for the federal government. So then I discovered like, oh, I really like this teaching and facilitation piece. Is there something in my current work environment that would help me do more of that at work? And the answer is yes. And that is through HR. So through learning and development within the HR department. So I started making some connections there and I actually started facilitating some training. And that kind of opened me up to the world of HR, but I always had an interest in management and leadership. And I think I sort of erroneously thought that through my interest in management and leadership could be played out through HR, which of course it can be to a certain degree. So that was kind of the convergence of like, oh, I can actually maybe turn this into a really interesting career that I really like, where, you know, I can be teaching and facilitating topics that are of interest to me. And it's kind of getting me out of the world that I was in. The other reality is that moving from the public sector to the private sector is very difficult. I have done it once before. I'll be doing it, you know, again at some point. And the two sectors don't really talk to each other very well. So that the common thread was HR. And so I got my CPHR designation, and that was really what helped me kind of transition out of the public sector into the private sector and find a better fit for me. And that was ultimately how my HR and career kind of kicked off. So it absolutely started with the federal government. But once I left is when I got into more sort of HR proper, if you will. And then I spent several years thereafter in various roles and organizations in HR.
Very cool.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I love having you on here, Christopher, because your career has been so successful, but also so unique in its evolution. It really has. And I think I met you shortly after your dance career, although I don't think I realized at the time how fresh you were out of that environment when I met you like 12 years ago or whatever it was. So one of the things that I love about your career is that you've worked in some very challenging industries. So in luxury hospitality, on cruise ships, traveling the world. I know you got tapped for a very special position in that regard, which I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about with this question. But I think what I admire about you is that you go in to work with these groups that are typically overlooked in terms of, you know, having much potential beyond where they are. People wouldn't necessarily be like, oh, yes, I'm so excited to get in there and get the absolute best out of these people. But you've really been able to do that. So explain to us what your approach is when you're given a mandate like that, so that you're able to really move the dial on the performance within those teams.
Yeah, so that mandate or kind of like what's the problem we're trying to solve is always, you know, the most important place to start. You did reference, you know, working with the housekeeping department. That project, which I'll talk a little bit about, remains one of my most proud professional accomplishments, that work that I was retained to do. So I was hired by a hotel that was really struggling with the overall performance, operational performance, and the quality and the reputation of the hotel was starting to suffer on account of the underperformance of the housekeeping department. So never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that I would be hired to go into a hotel to do an organizational assessment of a housekeeping department, and then ultimately completely turn it around, which I did and we did as a collective team. So going in there, you know, that fire in my belly and that determination of like getting to the root cause of the issue and then addressing it, you know, was very real, especially at that point in my career. But it was about a huge culture shift, because what had happened, of course, is that the culture in the hotel had developed around the underperforming housekeeping department, which then hid all sorts of other issues that were never being addressed. Or there was no systems thinking around how everything's interconnected. And therefore, you know, we're all in this together. And instead, it breaks up into departments and sort of, you know, territory, if you will. So with that one, that was really fascinating, because once I had completed my assessment and made some recommendations, the pathway forward was pretty clear to me. But it was that cultural evolution piece that was really important, and trying to bring the management team along as well as all of the staff, because that culture had permeated throughout. That took a long time. Like that took at least a year for things to truly start stabilizing. And we had the metrics, we had the receipts, you know, to demonstrate that, you know, these issues are no longer housekeeping. Maybe there is a challenge at the front desk or in maintenance or what have you. So it created this whole domino effect. And throughout that, I had to be an advocate for my project and my team, which was the housekeeping department, which I think is often kind of an under-supported and undervalued team within any, you know, hotel or cruise ship or organization. Whenever I then moved on, for example, into the cruise ship industry, it's an incredibly diverse workforce. Typically, we would say we had about 45 different nationalities on board. And it was a very, very hierarchical system. Even cruise ships, luxury cruise ships today, there's still a quasi kind of military approach to the overall structure and management from kind of military, well, obviously, you know, seagoing military. And so it's very hierarchical, and your station in life is very clear to you. And it's made clear by stripes that you have on your shoulders. So officers have stripes. The more stripes you have, the more senior, the more important you are. And then there are many, many, many crew that have no stripes at all. So automatically there's a schism that's created on board, or the company I worked for, there was a policy and procedures manual that clearly articulated, you know, if I had three stripes, here's what I was entitled to. So everything was based around the privilege of the system, of the positions that you were in. So there was a lot of kind of advocacy, I would say, that had to happen for some of those marginalized groups. I often think of, you know, dishwashers in large restaurants. You will have dozens and dozens of people whose job it is to, you know, process dirty dishes. It's a thankless job. It's hot. It's heavy. It's a lot like housekeeping. And so are there things that we can be doing from an HR perspective, partnering with management to better support those groups and better hear what their concerns are and respond to that and to those. And I also think, you know, as well, some of where my sensitivity to that comes from, of course, is as, you know, a gay man having grown up, you know, and been marginalized and or have been marginalized even as an adult, you know, I think it's important as a leader to bring our personal experiences into the work that we do. So there's also a real personal angle to the work that I do with those examples, recognizing I'm in a position of leadership and privilege, and it's my time to, you know, pay that forward and to, you know, use my authority and my influence to be able to better support groups like those that I just mentioned.
So for many of our listeners, I think COVID brought this whole international perspective to the workforce in the sense that we started hiring people from wherever it is that they were. The cruise ship industry has been doing that for years and in international waters. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a hint about some of the challenges and some of the benefits of working with such a multinational team?
Yes. So on one hand, it all works magically and beautifully. And, you know, you've got this microcosm. So the ships I worked on, we would have 1,350 employees, 45 different nationalities. Yeah. So it's a huge melting pot of people. And it was a melting pot. So we think about in Canada, you know, we have a, what is it, you know, our tapestry of multiculturalism, and everybody's encouraged to retain their identity. That wasn't really the case. You know, it was more the American model of a melting pot. So everybody was expected then to come to work. And when you cross the gangway, you were an employee of the company, and your cultural needs and sensitivities didn't necessarily come first. That said, the company was very sensitive to cultural needs. You think about Ramadan, for example. So there were great plans and exceptions made to operational norms to accommodate for that. And others, depending on the, Jennifer and I were chatting about this recently, although there's 45 different nationalities, the two largest are Indian and Filipino. And so by virtue of that volume, there tended to be more support and recognition of the needs of those cultures. So it was very difficult trying to balance sometimes that need of recognizing an individual and their cultural background, linguistic background, with the need for everybody to follow the same rules and the same norms. And one of the roles or jobs I had as a director of HR is that I had to deliver harassment training to management, senior leaders. And it was always a point of discussion that, you know, in my culture, you know, a hug and a tap on the bum is considered a compliment. And, you know, I would say, well, that's great for your culture, but you are not working in your culture. You're working for a large American, you know, multinational corporation with very clear policies and procedures. And so we're going to need you to check that cultural piece specifically at the gangway. You know, other items, of course, you know, as I mentioned around religion and religious holidays, et cetera, absolutely, you know, accounted for. So the challenges were about trying to create norms and trying to create a similar language that everybody could understand, accept, and get on board with. And sometimes that could just be very challenging. And so it was a matter of trying to work through that. That environment and the volume of issues is so high and so complex that there often isn't, you know, sufficient time to kind of dig into, like, is there a cultural element here or not? And it's more like, these are the rules, you need to follow them. You didn't follow them, you're being punished. There was always a need to kind of try and push and pull through some of those issues as they came up. And there were all sorts of other issues, even around food and healthcare was another big one where the cultural sensitivity piece was significant. The cruise ship industry is actually incredibly regulated. A lot of people don't think that it is. But one of the things that was regulated or the expectation was that you had culturally sensitive food on board. And so more than once I was engaged by crew or staff that didn't feel that the menu was representative of their cultural needs. And so then you'd have to work with the food and beverage department, for example, to have that addressed. And one of the biggest kind of projects I did when I was with that company is they were making a very aggressive play for China or the Chinese cruise ship market at the time. And, you know, we're investing a lot of time and resources and capital in that market. And so I went there in an effort to help integrate Chinese nationals at a level that had never been done before in the company. And there were a couple of new HR positions to support the Chinese market. But one of the issues that we discovered was the food issue. And so the corporate menus that were provided for crew were based on the previous balance of majority Filipinos and Indians, whereas in China, that was completely flipped. So there was a need then for the corporate office to change their menu cycle to reflect the needs of the Chinese crew. So that was something, for example, that I discovered, had to advocate for and bring forward. And as simple as it sounds, it was at times felt relatively complex to get done. And one of the ways in which we discovered there was a huge food issue beyond the obvious complaints was the number of visits that crew were paying to the medical center. So it was actually through the medical staff that identified a trend with the negative implications of the food that the Chinese nationals were eating. So, you know, you've got the health team, you've got the food and beverage team, you've got HR, and we're all coming together to try to address this very culturally sensitive issue that was having, you know, significant and real consequences to people.
So what's your advice to managers who might be leading multinational teams for the first time ever? How do you learn all of that?
Well, some of it you just kind of learn as you go. But I think, you know, that cultural sensitivity and that cultural awareness, I think, is just really important. And that's not about necessarily learning the ins and outs of every single culture of each of your team members, but it's recognizing that our worldviews are developed through our own eyes, and we're deeply influenced by, you know, our families, where we were raised, the culture around us, the language, our, you know, geopolitical situations, et cetera. So I would say my advice is to keep an open mind, be non-judgmental and curious, and be aware that there's so much that you don't know, and that the issues and challenges you may be dealing with, or even the successes, have that cultural element in there that you need to be mindful of. So it's just, it's an awareness piece. It's an openness piece. I think it's a curiosity, as opposed to thinking there's a right and a wrong way, or I absolutely need to go out and learn everything I can about this particular culture.
I think I finally found the thread that runs through your career that I was missing up to now. And it actually—
Tell me.
Yeah, I know. Well,
what
it
is
doesn't
it?
Seem completely random, but it is very broad, which we're going to get into exactly how broad in a minute. But it's advocacy. You know, that's because when you say, oh, I had this fire in my belly when I took over the housekeeping team, I think people are probably like, really? How is that? You know, but to you, I think they're just human beings, and you see a problem that you have the influence and sort of privilege to help solve. And I think that's the common thread. I finally figured it out.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it, I think. And Jennifer, you and I are friends, know each other. Like, one of the things I've talked about, or I've come to realize in my career, is that a people first environment is incredibly important to me. And so people are at the center of all decisions, whether you consciously want to make them or not. And it's to your benefit to make them part of the decision making process. But so often, I think we forget, ignore, or are afraid of that element. So for me, it's about a people centered environment. And if that includes advocacy, then I'm happy to have that label for sure.
Cool. I love that. So then you sort of moved out of what I would call more traditional HR roles into maybe now what we can frame as strategic advocacy for organizations in a more, I don't want to say global sense, because we'll get, but in a macro, more macro sense. So you moved into, I think, roles where you were strategically creating alliances that needed to be created in order for either quasi-governmental or actual governmental agencies to move forward. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, I want to know why you felt comfortable being able to do that. Like, what, how did you go from, you know, cruise ships 2 years before to doing strategic alliance work with sort of governmental type bodies?
So to answer your question, why I felt comfortable, I think in large part because others believed in me. And the person in particular who believed in me, I believe you're referring to my time with the Canadian Alliance for Skills and Training in Life Sciences.
Yeah.
And so the CEO, who at the time was responsible for that program, I think is a true visionary leader. And I think we throw that term around a lot these days. We think everybody's a visionary leader. I don't think they are. I think true visionary leaders are very, very rare in our world. And I believe that that Rory Francis is one of them. And I knew him because he had hired me as a consultant to do some work for him. And so I'd gotten to know him pretty well. So whenever he approached me with this opportunity, there was a large part of me that was like, if Rory thinks I can do it, I absolutely can do it. And there was so much I didn't know about that world and industry that I had to learn quickly. But that was ultimately where that came from. So to kind of back it up, I was working in operational HR. I was working for a fairly large private healthcare company that had a mix of pharmacies and long-term care homes. And it was an excellent opportunity. I went in there initially as a consultant, and then I stayed and became part of their senior leadership team. And I loved it. But by that point, I was getting very tired with HR operation. And I was wanting then to make a different and a more strategic move. I should also back up by saying, in part, why I went into the cruise ship industry was to get high volume operational HR experience. So here in our province, those opportunities are very, very rare. We don't have those types of large, complex organizations here. There are some, but not many. So my strategy was go get it elsewhere and then come back and kind of figure out what I want to do next. So I was wanting out of health operations. COVID absolutely accelerated that for me. And then the this opportunity came along where I was approached to become a program director for the Canadian Alliance for Skills and Training in Life Sciences. The acronym is CASEL. And that was really a vision or an idea where the biopharma and bio sector here in PEI and in the region came together and said, you know, there's some really good work being produced in the post-secondary at colleges and universities, but the grads don't have the technical skills that we actually need. They've got a great base and foundation, but they still need more training. And so we want more job-ready graduates, basically. And in the absence of getting that, they said, well, we're just going to take our fate into our own hands and we're going to create this new program called CASEL. So I came on board fairly early on, and I like to say we weren't a whole lot more than like a hope, a wish, and a really bad PowerPoint presentation that we were like trotting around to people looking for support and buy-in. So I became program director. And then within maybe 2 months, there was a change and I was promoted to executive director. So I took over that program. And my mandate was to build out this strategic workforce development, skills development program. And at the time, we had three skills. There was upskilling, reskilling, and new skilling, which was post-secondary. And so I was tapped to do that. And in fairly short order, we established some key partnerships with local universities and colleges. And then we started, you know, gaining some interest and profile. And so there was actually some fairly large players from the private sector in that biopharma world that began approaching us and sort of saying, well, do you think you can kind of maybe tailor a few things for us specifically? And so, you know, as much as that hope and vision was there, the business model started to develop as well and build out. I was only in that role a short time. I was only there about a year. Although I don't regret why I left, I regret not having more time in that job, you know, in such an inspiring space. So that was kind of what transpired there. It was just this beautiful timing lineup of me kind of going, I don't think I want to do health operations anymore. And then this more strategic HR opportunity coming along. And so I jumped at that because it was what I needed and wanted at the time. And that program has grown to be a very successful national program now. Certainly the current CEO of that program has done an incredible job these last few years of building a physical footprint for training in PEI, Quebec, and British Columbia. So, you know, it was super exciting and rewarding to look back and having been part of something at the beginning that's grown into something so successful. But that was my transition there. And then when I left there, I came to government as a deputy minister.
So what advice would you give to HR leaders who want to move from that day-to-day operations to influencing policy and strategy?
Just do it. I think that's my advice. Like, you just have to kind of do it and figure out the pathway there. The challenge is, like, we're always judged by the position we're currently in, right? And no matter, we all love to think that we're these big sort of like creative, bold thinkers around recruitment and talent. But at the end of the day, we really just kind of want the safest bet, the, you know, the most competent, most experienced, kind of capable person. And that likely means they're doing something similar to what you want to hire them do for today. So I think it's about strategically kind of building up some of your own arsenal, recognizing when you want to make that change by dipping into those areas as you can to build up a bit more kind of knowledge and experience. But it's also about demonstrating your value. How can you convince somebody that you're no longer an HR professional, but that as a result of having been an HR professional, you have this whole other world and sphere that you can open up to? In my experience, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, I don't see a lot of people moving out of HR. I see way more people moving into HR for maybe not always the right reasons, but I don't see a lot of movement out. But that would be my advice, is to just kind of do it and figure out what that pathway forward is and go ahead and do that. You know, for me, I have a varied background and policy was incredibly helpful whenever I came into HR. And I think that even today, that background, my policy background, my HR background is very relevant and useful for what I do every day. So it's about just kind of figuring out what you want to do and charting a pathway to get there.
I think that's really funny because the very first time we met, I met you briefly at like a Chamber of Commerce meeting. And then I knew you were sort of an HR person, but you were doing something very differently. And I think I wrote you up and said, hey, Christopher, you've got the most unique kind of HR career path I've ever seen. Let's talk about, you know, because I was sick of being in HR operations.
Yeah.
Obviously, I went in a very different direction than you did.
And I think too, just on that, like as an example, so I sat on that committee to get myself more experience in HR and more exposure to other HR professionals. But I'm pretty sure I was still working with the federal government at the time. I had maybe just got my CPHR designation or something. But we met because, to my point, I kind of said, well, I want to go over there. How do I get there? Here's a way for me to start sort of building out some of that experience, but some of that credibility and that change around me becoming more of a legitimate full-time HR professional.
So I want to double tap on that for a second, because Jennifer and I did an episode very early on. If you haven't listen to it. You should go check it out.
Okay.
About, you know, the pathway into HR. And for some companies, what you find is kind of whoever's available and whoever it is that they think is like people oriented or quote unquote a people person gets the job of HR. So as a professional, you made an intentional choice to move into HR and you used a word that I want to kind of focus in on, and that is about credibility. How did you build credibility? Because now, of course, you know that HR isn't just about being a pretty face in the office and being friendly to everybody. What were some of the tough lessons that you learned about transitioning into HR?
That often people don't want you at the table. That HR is often viewed as the police or the party planner. You know, that
never anything in between.
not a whole lot in between. You're absolutely right. Unless there's an issue or a crisis, and then they're happy to bring you to the table, and then they want you to be all things to all people. So some of those were some really challenging hurdles to get over that I didn't anticipate. And, you know, I was young and fresh and idealistic and kind of thought, oh my gosh, we're going to do all this great, great stuff together. I think what is really, I think, still alive today is that transition that HR has gone over in the last number of decades between being kind of the old personnel office, where somebody who was really good at administration went to work, or somebody who liked people went to work. But really now, like, HR has evolved, become like a strategic, you know, and valuable business function. So I felt like I was often caught in that sort of transition period, and I consider myself of the latter. So I think a couple of things I think you need to do is basically, you know, develop trusting relationships with managers and leaders, because ultimately they're the ones with the formal authority to manage usually whatever the situation is. And so you need to become like a very credible, trusted partner such that they feel comfortable coming to you. They're coming to you earlier and proactively so that you can work together, as opposed to it being like, oh, we have a problem, now it's HR's to fix, which of course is super common. So I think it's about also, and then being empathetic to those managers as well, and understanding that if they're an operational manager and they're going, you know, kind of like 24/7, well, the last thing they want is for somebody from HR to be coming in and talking to them about, you know, the benefits of learning and development. And could they just adjust their schedule a little bit more so we could get more people into training and development? Of course, that's super important and we need to focus on it, but the way in which you approach it is ultimately what's going to determine your success. So awareness and understanding of the business. So something I've always done, going back actually to the housekeeping example, is that for a full week, I shadowed housekeepers. And I felt like I really needed to understand, like, from start to finish, what their day looked like and what some of those challenges were. And then when I worked on ships, like, I would purposely go and ask for tours of different areas so that there was visibility and I was demonstrating interest and I was demonstrating a desire to understand so that I could be better at what I was doing. So I think getting out there and developing those relationships and not sort of staying behind the HR door is probably first and foremost in my experience, the number one way to build that credibility in those relationships.
Excellent advice.
So, Christopher, there are some questions we ask all of our guests, not to put you on the spot, but we're going to do one question and then we'll go into rapid fire. Okay.
Sure.
Ready?
I am ready.
All right. So what's the one thing that you believe small businesses could do today to change the game for their people?
I think seeing people is incredibly important. And I as cliche as that sounds, I really don't think we do it very well, generally speaking. So I think in a small business, your resources are going to be limited. You know, you're not going to have the bells and whistles that medium and larger organizations have. You probably don't have the professional services support either. So I think the number one thing you can do is, like, see your people for people, recognize they have agency, and then try to work together to figure out how this can be a mutually beneficial relationship. Recognizing that, you know, of course, there are limits to what they can provide. But I think it's working within what you have to be what you can. A small business is never going to be, you know, a large multinational that has all kinds of opportunity and benefits. So just be confident in what you have to offer, and that's likely a very positive, supported work environment, and focus on being able to provide that.
I love that. All right. So here's the rapid fire. Tell us about your first job.
My first job. Oh my goodness.
First job.
Well, my very first job, I was a paper boy. And so I delivered morning papers. Jennifer, this might blow your mind, but when I was a paper boy, like almost 40 years ago, Charlottetown actually had, or PEI had an afternoon newspaper as well. So I delivered a morning newspaper and then I delivered an afternoon newspaper after school. But my very first kind of like on the payroll type job, I was a dishwasher at the New Glasgow Lobster Suppers, which Jennifer would know. And so it's kind of, it's an island institution, you know, the bus tours pull up and you pump people through for this, you know, wonderful PEI lobster supper experience. And I was very young. I was, I think 12 or 13, maybe even 11. And I was so determined to like get out into the world and get my own job and my own independence. I worked on a huge conveyor belt of a dishwasher. There was probably like 9 of us that worked there, and everybody had a little station in your job. And then you'd rotate after half an hour, and it was super fun and exciting. And it was a great summer. So that was my first sort of official job beyond the paperboy.
Literally up to your elbows in shellfish juice.
Literally.
You loved
and loving it.
It
and loving it. I thought I had arrived. I was so independent. My wage was minimum wage at the time, which was $4 an hour.
You are showing your maritimer.
I know. How on brand of an experience is that? Yeah.
Okay, Christopher, what was your best job?
You know, I worked when I was in university both times, fresh out of, and then when I went back, I worked at a hospital as a porter. And basically as a porter, it's like you're a runner. And so we had walkie-talkies and you would call central dispatch if you needed something. And it could be transferring a patient. It could be running some blood to the lab. And then there were daily activities that everybody had. And that was probably one of my favorite jobs because it was this wonderful mix of, it was very organized. The roles and responsibilities were very clearly defined, but there was some freedom and autonomy with it, right? You were kind of out doing your own thing. We had some control over our workload and what have you. So that always kind of springs to mind as like a really great job that I had once. You know, my current job, of course, has afforded me some incredible experiences, truly career highlights without a doubt. And then going back to when I was executive director of Castle, that was a very special experience as well.
So there was swagger with that walkie-talkie, I bet.
Oh my gosh, you bet. And like, and then there was swagger with like certain responsibilities that you had. Like there was a pecking order. And then of course there was like the more senior people and did they want you working with them? And there was like, there was a whole world that was happening there, but the control of that walkie-talkie, you're absolutely right. It was big.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
All right. Tell us about your biggest mess up at work.
Wow. So the immediate image that comes to mind, I don't know if in the end this is a huge mess up or not, but I worked at like a refreshment stand here at the Confederation Center of the Arts one summer. And it was this incredibly unwieldy like cart that we had with all the treats on it. And there was a big like soda fountain on it and stuff. And we had to take it in and out every day for these lunchtime shows. And I was going down like a basically a wheelchair ramp, and I lost control of the cart and it went over the curb and it smashed and the fountain fell off and like passerbys were helping me. So that was the immediate image that sprung to my mind. I'm now afraid to know what other memories are in there that you may be able to call on, but that's kind of what immediately comes to mind. And then in terms of mess ups, like other things that have happened, when I was in the cruise ship, we actually had a really complex sexual assault case ahead of us. And the captain was always the final decider. So we would have these captain's hearings. They were very regulated, you know, employees had an opportunity to plead their case and what have you, but the forms were auto film, like a PDF fillable form. And so it was all click down menus. And I accidentally clicked on the wrong infraction as to like why we were calling this man in front of the captain. And the captain reads out the form and he reads out the wrong infraction. And like, I wanted to die in that moment because this was so high stakes. It was so high drama. And here my little admin error is kind of throwing the whole thing off. So I remember we had to ask for a pause in the meeting and I had to like, you know, beg for forgiveness and sort of like, yes, I'll stick handle this when he comes back in and what have you. So those are probably two sort of like, you know, younger jobs and then a more professional mistake as well. So
did you have to scrub the decks?
No, no, they wouldn't. No,
no. No scrubbing decks.
There's still versions of that exist, but it wouldn't be for the HR director. You'd be more just sort of like isolated or iced out or something, you know?
Go on.
Yeah, exactly.
That's better.
Do that. I guess that's more for pirates, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Best learning.
Best learning is like two things. One, don't hold yourself shackled to your judgmental views of your younger years. And that's a big one for me because I know certainly when I was fresh in my career, I had so many definitive ideas about the way the world was supposed to work and the way that leaders were supposed to work that all of those ideas have been blown apart over the years. And so I find as I get older and more mature and into more sort of senior and complex roles, that's something that I have had to learn is that self-forgiveness and the awareness of what I was doing and thinking and the need to actually let that go. And then I think my other learning is just the importance of putting people first and being a human and being as authentic and as vulnerable as you possibly can. That was a really big challenge for me as well, because certainly I vividly remember as a young person saying, like, why on earth is that person talking about their children or their family life or what they did in the weekend? Like, we're here to work. We have to be really good, competent, skilled people. And I was just so wrong, right? And so as I became a leader, I had to get very comfortable, having that type of conversation with people and getting to know them and build those relationships. So I think it's the humanity of it all is what I've learned about most.
All right, Jennifer, what's the last one?
Okay, my favorite, your quickest quit.
So I kind of have two again that sprung to mind. When I was in high school, I took a strategic pause on my education. So I was out of high school for a year and a half. And of course, it caused great pandemonium in my family and those around us. And it was like, he can't quit high school. And I'm like, listen, I'm not quitting. I just need a little pausette. All right. Like, this is a lot. So I was out for a year and a half. And during that time, I was looking for work and I got hired by a call center. And it was kind of in the earlier days of like call centers sort of coming to Canada. So it was this like new thing and, the sky was the limit in terms of your earnings potential and what have you. And I think I maybe lasted like maybe two shifts. But the other one was the summer after I graduated with my undergrad, where I now had this fancy undergraduate degree. And I thought I was, I had made it, much like my earlier desire to be a theater star. And so I was pretty sure like all the job offers should be coming in for me and I should have like a really awesome professional summer job. But I couldn't find one. So I ended up having to go back to work in the hospitality industry temporarily. And I got hired at this cafe and they brought me in for 4 hours of training. And I think after 2 hours, I was like, you know what? I think we both know that this is just not for me. And I'm just going to save everybody any more time or energy and I'm going to leave. And the manager was like, you know what? Fair enough. I appreciate that. Thank you. And I'm like, super. We'll see you later. And then I was out after, I think, 2 hours. So, yeah.
All right. Advocacy and courage.
Yes.
Those are your takeaways from this conversation. Have both.
Good. Yep.
Christopher, thank you so much for coming on today. And it's been a really, really interesting chat. And I hope our listeners really enjoy hearing it. And just thanks so much for your time and all the best as you move forward in whatever life has coming at you next.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I appreciate the invite and the conversation. Always a pleasure.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Just JKing. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and took away some valuable insights to shake up your own HR game.
If you loved this episode, and we hope you did, make sure to hit that subscribe button, leave us a review, and share it with your network. We want to hear your thoughts, your feedback, and even your own wild HR stories.
And don't forget to connect with us on LinkedIn or drop us a message. Let us know what topics you want us to dive into next.
Until next time, keep it real, keep it human, and always keep JKing.
We'll see you next time on Just JKing. Thanks for listening.